Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patty LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain. And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. And kids, follow us on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
Plus, you can always listen to all of our episodes, old and new, on the Broadway Podcast Network, iTunes, and Spotify.
Today's guest is one of the most recognizable faces in film and television, whose talents have added iconic moments to such television shows as Spin City, Scrubs, Cougar Town, and of course, the cinematic masterpiece, The Rocky Horror Picture Show.
But today, we are gleefully exploring his onstage credits, which include originating the role of Danny in Broadway's Grease, winning a Tony Award for The Robber Bridegroom, appearing in all three performances of Soon, and dazzling audiences with his debonair air in Nick and Nora.
To tell us what it was like to work with such legends as Ellis Rabb, Lois Nettleton, Peter Allen, Nell Carter, Arthur Lawrence, and so many more, here is Golden Globe winner himself, Mr. Barry Bostwick. Barry, how are you today?
Hello. I'm doing fine. Did you just hear my computer go ding?
No, we did not hear it go da-ding-da-ding.
Okay, well, here, I'm going to start again then. Oh, hi, guys, I'm fine.
it's so good to have you here. Now, Mr. Bostwick, I think you are one of our first guests that has circus training, being involved with the circus. How did you get involved with Ringling Brothers?
Oh, well, you know, it's there's two parts to that.
Great.
I went to NYU School of the Arts in 67, and Hubby Burgess, who was worked at Ringling Brothers years ago, and then he taught circus arts for the actor at Juilliard and at NYU, and so I studied with him at NYU for the year I was there, and then he started a Circus Arts Institute down on the Bowery, just about three blocks below from where I lived, and he got about 8 or 10 of his ex-students, and we would go out into the park on the weekends and do a little improvised show with juggling and this and that, and we'd we called ourselves Cerco dell'Arte, I don't know what that means.
I think
it's the art of circus or something. My fondest memory of all of that with him was at this little storefront. I remember one night we got the mats out and we had a little black and white TV and we set up in the corner and we watched Armstrong come down out of the capsule and walk on the moon.
Oh, wow.
It was fascinating. And to be with those people, it's just one of those memories. But the point is that I learned how to juggle and do a bunch of walking on balls and all that kind of stuff with Hovey. And then when it came time, years later, they were putting together a rock and roll, group, sort of like the Monkees, and they wanted to call them the Clowns with a capital K, and it was being put together by Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey, which had nothing to do with my background and nothing to do with Hubby Burgess or anybody. It's just that I had these certain skills, and they cast five of us in this group, and we were going to be the hosts of a TV show. Like where they would bring on an hour special where they would bring on circus acts and stars. And it wasn't like Circus of the Stars where the stars did circus acts. It was just that they brought on their circus people and then they would bring on a star or two. And we did a pilot with Sammy Davis Jr.
Oh.
And it was never picked up. And in fact, I didn't do the pilot, even though I was the lead singer in the group, because I was doing a show off-Broadway called Colette with Zoe Caldwell, and they wouldn't let me out for the week to go do this, those bastards, so I could actually make some money rather than, working at the Ellen Stewart Theater for $7.50 a night. So they cast somebody else to play my part, and thank God all the characters had these sort of clown makeups on, sort of I played Bo, who was the hip guy, you know, the hip,
of course,
fringy kind of guy. But we had an album.
Lady Love, I think, made it, like, did pretty well, I think. I read somewhere that
Lady Love
song.
Did great. Oh, yeah. My God. I think it was, 37 with a bullet going down. But Jeff Barry, who had, who produced the album, had done an awful lot of this bubblegum stuff, and he was, yeah, he was very big in all that. And he did the Archies, and so we thought we were going to have a little run with all this. But after the show wasn't picked up, and after our first album, and after the bullet was going down, we disbanded. But there was actually some pretty good music on that album, and I wish you'd play the whole album right now. But Lady Love is sort of a cool song, and it was a fun time for the 6 months or however long it was that we did it. And so do you see the combination between Hubby Burgess, who was this great teacher, and then it carried over into Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey? And one of the exciting things about Ringling Brothers is that we went out and did a short tour for the show, and we got to hang around when they were auditioning acts for the circus, and to watch these spectacular athletes do what they were doing, and to just sort of be part of the whole thing.
Yeah. That's really fantastic. Now, New York is a far way from California. How did you discover theater and performing when you were growing up in California?
Oh, well, that's interesting. I didn't. I didn't. I mean, I went to high school. You know, I started doing plays in high school once I realized that that's where all the pretty girls were on campus.
Right. We've heard that many times.
Oh, yes. God, yeah. And, you know, and then my girlfriend, who was at the time a dancer, I would be her dance partner for her little local shows, and then I had another girlfriend who was in a community theater somewhere in Walnut Creek, and I remember I drove a good 2 hours to get to her to do Babes in Toyland, where I played the bad guy. I forget his name, whoever. All I remember is that halfway through one of the performances, my mustache fell off, and it was my first attempt at improvisation, or just like trying to hold my mustache on while I was speaking. Mm. But she was very pretty, so it was worth the drive. After high school, I did our Hill Barn Theater, which is our local community theater. I did Little Mary Sunshine, and I wore way too much makeup and overacted like crazy. But that's what you do then.
How did you know you could sing?
I had different groups in high school where we were folk singing groups, you know, and I had one group, a guy named Ron Jefferson, and I, we called ourselves Ron and Barry. And believe me, I wanted to call it Barry and Ron, but it just didn't seem to scan the same way as Ron and Barry. And we did a local talent show in San Francisco. We were beat on the air, and we were beat by an accordion player. I'll never forgive them. But we were singing, you know, we were singing folk music. And then I had a couple of gals I sang with in high school singing folk music and playing the guitar. It's what you did, you know, back then. You did folk music. You didn't do punk rock or anything. You just did, anything that you would sing at a bonfire around the beach and try to pick up girls. There's a theme to all of this.
I see a theme. Yeah. Did you major in acting at school and college?
What I did was I went to college in San Diego, at Cal Western University. It's a small, it was a small Methodist liberal arts college, because it was the only other. I got accepted to two colleges. I was a major C student throughout high school.
Same.
And I got, accepted to a college in the cold Northeast, somewhere up by Chicago. And then I was accepted at this little college in San Diego. And I thought, well, it's warmer and I'll go there. And also the dormitories were on cliffs overlooking the ocean. Oh. And it was a beautiful campus. And after my third year there, the school was bought by United States International University, and they started an acting program where you actually got a Bachelor of Fine Arts in acting. They started like a professional theater program because Pasadena Playhouse had closed down, and a lot of their teachers came down and started this program at USIU. And so I actually graduated with a Bachelor of Fine Arts specifically in acting. And then I went to NYU, and then I went to New York to NYU to work on my master's at, and I lasted 1 year there. But they still think I graduated, which I didn't.
And, amazing.
I think it's just for fundraising, you know, they want to.
Absolutely.
And so I didn't. I was there 1 year, but then I started working I actually had a real job, got some real jobs. And for that year that I was at NYU, I, to make a little extra money, I took coats at Puerto Rican weddings uptown. And I sold and I sold programs and refreshments at the Lyceum Theater because I had been a journeyman with the APA Phoenix, Ellis Rabb's group.
Yeah.
I had auditioned originally when I was in California to be a background extra in their production of War and Peace, which was at the Greek Theater. They hired me to come in and be a flag carrier, which I did. This is when I was still in college. And then at the end of that summer, they said, does anybody want to audition for the company? And I said, yeah, I'll audition for the company, even though I still had a year left of college. And they accepted me. And they said, well, you want to be a journeyman in the APA Phoenix? And I said, well, I got to finish school first. And then I said, I wanted to come to NYU. And Ellis, who was one of my mentors because he liked me and he thought I was talented for some reason, and he said, well, let me talk to the people at APA and we'll see how we can work this out. And they actually paid for my plane ticket to come to NYU for that year that I wasn't with them other than selling programs in the lobby. But it gave me a chance to stand in the back of the theater every night and watch Helen Hayes and watch these wonderful actors night after night after night. So it was an amazing incubation process for me as an actor who was studying in New York, which is where I think you should study.
So let's talk about Ellis Rabb for a little bit. What was your relationship like with him, and what are some of the lessons that he taught you that you still take with you today?
I think one of the main things he said was just don't do anything. Just stand there and don't do anything. Mm-hmm. He said, you are enough. You don't need to act. I eventually was in the production of Hamlet at the Lyceum, where he played Hamlet. And one of the great reviewers called it Spamlet. I don't think it was a very good show, but he played Hamlet. I played the ghost of Hamlet's father.
Oh.
I was all rigged up with smoke machines under this gauzy gown and floated around the stage, and I never opened my mouth because he did all the voiceover of his father.
Oh.
And then I played Osric in your classic homosexual way.
Right.
You have to. And then, and so that's, and Ellis Ellis, I became a fan of his, and he became a fan of mine. And he would like take me places to witness what the world of the theater was like. You know, we'd go to Bernstein's house and hang there for an evening with him and the great ballet dancers of the time, and we'd just sit and chat. And I don't know if I did much chatting. I was more like a fly on the wall for most of those little outings with Ellis. But no, Ellis and I stayed friends throughout his whole life. And I think that he was a true sort of theatrical genius was certainly just a good friend and introduced me to an awful lot of what the theater was like in New York in the late 60s. And probably if I hadn't have had that relationship with Ellis, well, because then APA Phoenix broke up and it became just Phoenix. And then I did, They Knew What They Wanted?
Or, yeah.
Yeah. And then I did a production of They Knew What They Wanted. I was part of their ensemble. And I was lucky enough to get a Tony nomination for Best Supporting Actor for that. And so yeah. He's a very important man in my life. And probably if he hadn't entered my life, I wouldn't have been so enthusiastic about being on stage and learning the craft that way.
So he, like you said, he introduces you to the world of theater in the 1960s, and he's so supportive of you. Were your parents supportive of you going into this career path?
Oh yeah. I think my mother was in like little community theater in San Francisco, and my father was the stage manager for some little productions in San Francisco. And so they had the bug, but you know, they couldn't pursue it because they had children. And then my father was a banker for a while. And then, he became, the vice president of the of an industrial development business in San Mateo County, and but he was a great speech maker. So I learned a lot. I think he would have he enjoyed everything I did. He would come to New York, and my mother would come to New York and see me and things, and be very encouraging. Except for the night that Grease opened. My father was there for the opening night of Grease, and we went to Sardi's afterwards, and the reviews started coming in, and they were mixed, and we got a little drunk, and as we were going back to my loft down the Bowery, my father said, you know, this will never last. Well, you got to find another job.
Oh.
This isn't going to go anywhere. So I held that over his head, you know, as we became the longest running show on Broadway, and saying to him, you don't know what the hell you're talking about theatrically. You have no idea. Both my parents were very, very supportive, and, you know, they helped me through school. I got just a little bit of a scholarship, but they paid for the rest of it. And, you know, every time I would do a little college production in San Diego, they would drive down from the Bay Area, and I did not have to fight them one bit to pursue what I wanted to pursue.
Now, you know, you mentioned Danny and Grease, but before we get to that, Kevin, do you want to ask about Soon and Shelter?
Yeah, I'm really fascinated by some of these pop musicals from the early 70s, 1971 to be for this one. This was a musical, a pop opera that Soon I'm talking about specifically, that was Louis St. Louis wrote it, and Nell Carter was in there with you, Peter Allen. Can you tell us a little bit, do you remember this show?
I don't remember that Louis, I don't think Louis St. Louis wrote it. Soon?
Oh, maybe not.
That was a show with Richard Gere and myself.
Yep.
And the drummer from The Loving Spoonful. And we played a sort of like a Beatles-like group that came together, became big stars, and then dissolved. And you know, it was like soon. Oh, Peter Allen was in it. He was great. He had one good, great song. But the other people you mentioned, yeah, it was with a bunch of almost their Broadway singers who just performed the hell out of the show. Unfortunately, I took over from the guy who wrote it like a week before they opened. And so I had very little rehearsal time. In fact, the guitar player in that, who was in the band, was also the guitar player in Grease. And he said he didn't even remember me in the show. So that shows you.
Jesus.
That showed you how either short the show was or how sucky I was in it.
We're going to say how short the show was.
It was a short run. Yeah, it was a very short run.
What was it? Two nights? Three nights?
Yeah, I think three. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did a show called Nick and Nora back in the early 90s. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, you spend so much time rehearsing and changing and this and that. And then all for rehearsal pay. And then you go, okay, when this opens, boy, I'm going to be able to pay my rent. And with soon, it closed too soon. You know, it closed 2 days after we opened. So basically, we were all working for nothing. And the same thing with Nick and Nora. And we'll probably talk about that a little bit later. But it was the same situation where we previewed for 2 months, I think. And by the time we opened for 10 days. And I think I got one full paycheck out of it. And,
oh my God,
you know, it cost me money. You know, it cost me money because I had rented an apartment in New York. I had a house in L.A. And
Nick and Nora was the last show that you did on Broadway. And was one of the reasons not to return because of that, because it's such a large, you know, time investment with very little financial return?
Yeah, I think one of them. And the other one was my manager actually pushed me into doing that. Her name was Lois Zetter, and she had been in a production of something on Broadway. And I think she was a frustrated actress, and now she was a manager. And she wanted me to do this show. I really didn't want to do it. As I knew it was going to be such a life upheaval of having to move to New York and this and that. But I agreed to do it. I agreed to audition, and then I got the part. When we got the part, they still didn't have all their money. So we had to do a sort of a workshop-y kind of backers audition for it. And I remember that we did all the rehearsals for the backers audition. And in between that and when we actually did the audition, I was doing a mini series or something in Australia. And I went up to Bali for a vacation or just to sort of hang out for a little while with a friend. And when I came back to New York, all of a sudden I got very sick. And where was I? At the Warwick, the old Warwick Hotel. I remember I was throwing up in front of the lifts, you know, the elevators.
Oh, wow.
And I remember, oh, God, there's something wrong. This isn't quite right. Yeah. So I got to the hospital, and they finally discovered I had malaria. And so I couldn't do the backers audition. And they were so pissed off at me. They thought that, oh, I was, you know, being careless and reckless and
right.
And I had screwed up their whole thing. And they finally found some money, and then they lost some money, and then they found some money. It was one of those deals. And and they couldn't afford to go out of town. So we did all of our previews in town. That's a horrendous process. You're rehearsing every day. You're performing at night, and at night you're doing something different than you did the night before. And it was very stressful. And I didn't enjoy the process one bit. And I also thought that the show was going in the wrong direction from the get-go. It It didn't have the charm that Nick and Nora should have had. It became this sort of dark murder mystery, very convoluted story that I, to this day, still don't know who did it. And it was a hard show to do.
So let me ask you though, when you're in a rehearsal situation like that, and you can feel this is going in the wrong direction, do you speak up? Do you talk to the director and say, hey, listen, I'm uncomfortable with this, or do you just try to be a good soldier and not in your wheelhouse, not in your line of duty?
No, I tried talking with who was the director on that?
It was Arthur Lawrence.
Oh yeah,
Arthur Lawrence. Yes. Arthur Lawrence. I will fall into the category of not a huge fan of Arthur Lawrence.
I think you're
it's a very popular. You're in a popular club there. From people.
Yeah, that's what I think. And so I remember way back in the beginning, me just doing whole character analysis and writing these long things to him. And how about if we tried this? And well, he didn't listen to any of it. Just basically threw it away. And so I realized early on that I was going to have no input into this, and I was just going to be his stooge. And in fact, I don't know why he should have fired me, and it would have been a blessing. Joe Mantegna was, he and I were up for the same part, and I saw him a couple of years ago. I said, God damn it, why didn't you get the part? You know, you would have been great, you know, because he had that sort of more straight thing going, and he said it was a blessing that I got the part. So it was not a great time. Let's put it this way. I was not so happy with the whole thing that on a closing night, just to give the finger to Arthur, unfortunately, I organized the closing night party at Joe Allen's, and we presented Joe Allen's with a poster from the show. And because it was a closing night party, Arthur and all the producers, who I quite liked, had to show up and just sort of dig their nose into the loss of 5 or 6 million, or it was the biggest loss at the time of any show on Broadway. But I was so pissed off at Arthur and at the way he was treating people, not just me, but he treated everybody except for Joanna. She was his, you know, muse, as I said. But he had the tendency to tear somebody down in a rehearsal or in a performance, and then the next 3 days build them back up again. But it just in a very sort of mean-spirited way. I'm a nice guy, and I just don't like to see other people abused like that. Yes. And I think he was a true abuser of his. And also, he didn't listen to anybody. I mean, we would hear stories of him going out with Hal and Steve, and all those people. They would go out and have dinner afterwards, and they would say, well, you know, Arthur, this should really be like this, this, and this. And Arthur would never take anybody's advice. This was going to be his show. It was going to be, because he'd always been like a part of every other show, either the writer or the producer. Right. But this was going to be his show, soup to nuts. And because he was of his ego, he lost an awful lot of money and pissed off an awful lot of people. And I got back in amidst Joe Allen's on closing night.
Ian, what do you look for out of a director?
Kindness, talent, a vision of the whole, patience, and somebody who, and for me, allows me to do something different in every rehearsal, and then remind me of the best thing that I did. It could have been 2 weeks ago, it could have been yesterday, in terms of a choice that I was making, because I have a tendency to make too many choices And I keep, because I get sort of bored, and I'm always like searching for what I think is the best thing, the best choice. Yeah. And so I will circle what the right thing is many times for weeks on end. And eventually the director will, steer me in the right direction. And that's what I need. I need somebody who gives me free range to explore, and then goes, well, you remember last Tuesday when you did it this way? I think that's the best choice. And I would go, oh yeah, I guess so. Oh, yeah, you're right. And then
Now, what is your acting process in terms of, you know, prepping for a role? Do you like to do a lot of work beforehand? Do you like to go into the rehearsal and trust your gut instincts? What's your process?
I came out of a college situation where you learned how to break down your character and write, you know, write backstories and, you know, well, where was he before the scene? Where is he going? Where is he coming from? What does he want? What does he need? You know, all of that stuff. And I used to do all that in the beginning. And like I said, with Arthur, I did all of that and I wrote it out and I, you know, and then he totally rejected it, or maybe it was sucked. I don't know, but he rejected it. And now I think a lot of that process is just sort of built in. I have a feeling that I just have an instinct for creating or just being a character. I don't need to come up with every nuance of who he is. It's just sort of there. I just sort of trust the process, but I'll still you know write out and explore if the character can go in so many different directions. If it could be, you know, and I have to sort of choose, you know, what the main thrust of him is.
More specifics.
I can be more specific that way, but. You know, I do a lot of television and I do a lot of things where I'm basically just being myself. And the challenge is to try, like going back to Ellis Rabb, don't do anything, just be yourself, just stand there, just trust that you are enough. And I think that is the hardest lesson that any actor, you know, has to practice. But when you look at the movie stars and people who are historically, I mean, you know, from Harrison Ford on back, you know, they don't attempt to create anything other than just themselves comfortable with the material.
You know, I hate to put you on the spot, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Who are some of the scene partners that you've had that have just, you know, really excited you, that if you could work with them forever and ever, you absolutely would, living or dead?
I think the best actress I've ever worked with was Patty Duke. She played, you know, Martha Washington, and I played George Washington in this long miniseries. And Patty or Anna, and I could never call her Anna. Everybody called her Anna because that was, I don't know if that was her real name or something. I just knew her from her television show. So she was always Patty to me, but, there was never any semblance of acting with her. And she made you be as genuine and as real and as calm and as focused as she was, but you never saw that she was doing anything other than just being herself and being available and giving to you as another human being. And so it was, I don't know, that was the best. That was probably one of the best, if not the best, experiences I've ever had with an actress. Only because she just made me better.
Yeah.
You know, and that was And it was a hard job because it, the dialogue was sometimes very stilted and sort of historically correct and this and that. And so it, she brought a humanity to her character, which in turn forced a humanity out of George Washington and me playing George Washington, which I think carried through the whole miniseries, because that's how it was seen, that it was one of the first times that we saw George Washington as a man, as opposed to just an icon.
Yeah. Right. And for our listeners who haven't seen it, we encourage you to seek it out, because it's really brilliant performances from both Mr. Boswick and Miss Duke. Really fantastic.
Hello, this is Bette Davis. Not the young one, the old one. I've been on matches.com looking for a gentleman who might like to date an actress who loves to smoke and who had a black and white career. And I thought, why am I wasting my money on this when I could merely donate it to those boys at Behind the Curtain? Go to patreon.com and give all you can. God knows they need it. And do it before you're 122 years old. That's Patreon.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
What was that experience like putting Grease together? Did you know, creating it, that it was going to be this massive hit?
No, we didn't. No, we didn't. No, we were just trying to pay our rent. Mm. You know, we knew that it was something that hadn't been really done before. You know, the 50s hadn't really been explored on stage a lot. Maybe one, you know, one song here or there, you know, One Last Kiss, So Give Me One Last Kiss, you know, you know, there'd be one song that would be a retro. But to do a whole sort of tongue-in-cheek 50s thing hadn't really been done before. And because it was before Happy Days, it was before all of those things.
But now you're in a hit show. So now, you know, you've done a couple of these other shows before that weren't long running hits by any means. But now you're I mean, for not knowing that it was going to turn into this big, big, huge sensation. I mean, what was that like to ride that wave? It must have been a really thrilling time, especially to be with such a family of young people and, you know, hanging out all the time. I mean, it's a good time to be in New York City.
Yeah, it was. Let me think. What was it like? How many years ago was it? First of all, 50 years ago? Is it 50 already?
You know, and in the 70s, you know, New York was getting like there. Times Square area was kind of dangerous. I mean, it was, people talk about that. It was a really gritty, really dangerous, you know, kind of scary place for some people. But that includes the Broadway area. I mean, people would have to walk in pairs. Some, you know, guests have told us before that it was, you know, a little seedy.
But that was one of the appeals to me. You know, certainly to walk down 42nd Street and feel like your life was in danger, you know, and then to slip into some club and then slip out of it, anonymously. But no, it was, but again, that was the time that when you were doing a show like Grease and you were playing these guys that were part of a gang, even though the gang was a little cotton candy. I mean, it wasn't like the gang that when Grease was done in Chicago in the basement of a church where, it was really about a gang. I mean,
yeah.
And a lot of these guys who were portrayed in Grease were real people. Jim Jacobs and they were part of this gang in Chicago. And so they wrote this show about their experiences and then just heightened it with, with all of that.
You know, Grease is going to be a show that outlives everybody. You know, it's going to be around for years and years and years and years. What advice do you have to people that are going to take on the role of Danny Zuko at some point?
It's a difficult show because it can be so overplayed and so overdone and so caricatury, whatever that word is. And people, you have to be... at the heart of it, there's a genuineness and there's a sweetness to these characters, and they're all just sort of blustery, and but they're basically 16, 17 year old kids, with huge egos and a lot of potential, and but are just blowing a lot of steam off, and. But underneath it all, they're just sweet young kids, And I've always wanted to see a production of Grease with 15-year-olds, just not trying to be the adults playing 15-year-olds, right. but with that, with that sweetness underneath it all. I mean, like John Travolta in the movie. I mean, he captured an awful lot of that sweetness in his character. He was in the touring company with me the first national tour for a while, and he played Duty. So he was, he got it, and also he's such a sweet guy. I mean, he got. That thing, that I think that it requires. And I don't know, there's just a sweetness to it that you can't just be all, oh, hey, man, it's got to be, you got to see underneath all of that bravado. I've seen many productions of it over the years, and as it was revived on Broadway, it just got glitzier and glitzier. And then they'd start adding music from the movie. And then they'd start adding music from the pop charts, it in their attempt to bring it up to date and to make it even big enough for a Broadway stage, they lost the core, the sweetness and the core of those kids just trying to grow up at a weird time,
if we can find a production that can return to that innocence that's underneath the surface of the show, we might have something interesting.
Yeah. Don't you think so?
Definitely. I think Kevin and I, we were talking about that at one point, which is, it just seems to have morphed into this very large, like, theme park type entity over the years. And it'll be nice to go back to it, to its roots. I wanted to ask you, before you did the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which is also another iconic thing from this era, had you done a lot of on-camera work?
No, I did a lot of commercials in New York when I was starting out.
What did you sell?
I sold soaps and shampoos, and I was one of the ring around the collar guys at one point. I made a living like a lot of young actors did. I spent a lot of time auditioning for commercials and doing commercials, and I sort of learned, that's how I learned how to do camera or be a little more comfortable in front of a camera with just doing commercials. And because there wasn't a lot of film going on at the time in New York.
How did Rocky Horror come about then? How did you get the audition for Rocky Horror?
Well, I didn't audition for it. They just gave it to me because I had a history of musical theater. And so,
yeah.
And the guy who cast it, Joel Thurm, in L.A., he was a close friend with my manager, and he had this idea that Susan and I would be great together as the young American couple, the quintessential young American couple. And
yeah.
So he had us just come to the theater and meet the creators and just talk with them. And I don't ever remember singing or anything. I think Susan says that she had to sing Happy Birthday or something, but I think that's a wife's tale. I don't think she had to sing anything. I'm under the impression that 20th Century Fox pushed us on these people, and because they wanted some real Americans in it, because in London, where it was done, the Americans were played by Brits, and so it was, you know, and Meatloaf, I think, was the only other, but Meatloaf had done it on stage in L.A., but Susan and I had never done it before, so we were fresh. We were like fresh meat, just like in the movie, you know.
Yeah.
We showed up in London, went right into pre-record rehearsals and just started filming. And it was a very short 4-week shoot, I think. And,
oh, wow.
It was just, you know, we didn't really have time to fraternize with anybody. We didn't get to know them very well because we were living in London having to transport to Windsor about an hour and a half outside of London. Wow. Every morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, and then go back to London and then wake up early and go, you know, it was work. It was a hard job. It looks like it was a lot of fun, but I was wet the whole time, and
it was cold too. Wasn't it really cold? Yeah.
Yeah. It was right before Christmas, and we were shooting in a castle house thing that half the roof was gone. So it was raining down on us, and there was no toilets on this little one sound stage, and the pool was freezing. And I wish I remembered more of the good times. I just remember how hard it was.
Yes.
You know, I just remembered how even though I was honored to be part of what I thought was a very creative group of British artists at the time who were, you know, a lot of them came from Jesus Christ Superstar, you know, and they were, I think, a lot of them were starting out or just in the beginning of their careers, whether it was the film, whether it was the DP or the editor or a lot of the actors, you know, in it. It was an exciting time because I knew I was surrounded by talent.
Yeah.
You know, and that makes a huge difference.
Do you think your participation in that film opened doors for you, or did it close any doors for you later on?
I don't think it did anything other than right now, later on, I do a lot of web series and small indie features where the director will say, you know, I was such a huge Rocky Horror fan. And I've had people give me jobs because I think they just wanted me to tell them stories about Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh, wow.
and I would say to them pretty soon into the job, I would say, I don't remember a goddamn thing. So, you know, you're going to have to just take me as I am. But there's a lot of young directors or directors now who were influenced by that movie, by the style and the color and the tone of that movie. And it, I think it's a brilliant film. So I'm,
yep.
I'm a big fan of it, and I do all I can to keep it alive with the Shadowcasts around the world, and I'll do one-nighters, and I'll go out and I'll introduce the film, and I've gotten to know a lot of the kids who are the Shadowcast people. A guy named Larry Wiesel, who's the head of the fan club now and has a cast in New Jersey, and he and I will go out and do one-nighters, you know, around the Halloween time. The last couple of years, where we'll go to a theater, like a theater in Albany or something, and they'll still pull in 1,000 kids, you know, or people, and I'll introduce the film, and there'll be a shadow cast, and it'll be a whole evening, and you know, they'll sell their prop bags, and people will throw shit at me, and you know, that's it. You know, that's what's fun. I just did a couple of weeks ago. I just did a tour of drive-ins where I would go and we would do the show in a drive-in, like in Phoenix and Tucson and up on the East Coast. I did 3 or 4.
Yeah.
And and I did it almost more so that I could keep those casts alive, because they haven't. The shadow casts, you know, haven't done anything since the beginning of the year.
Right.
And there a lot of their theaters where they would normally do their show have either closed, or certainly people weren't going to the theaters because they were closed. But a lot of the actual venues had closed down because of the lack of business. And so they were all scrambling for some place to do the show. So I'm to that group, I'm like Uncle Barry, and I love it.
It's so nice to hear that. I have to ask you, if I can, about another movie very quickly, just because I think this person is such a legend. But you got to do Movie with George C. Scott, a titan of just about all mediums. What was it like working with him?
Well, the first day I worked with him, I think I was doing the scene where I was dancing on the desk, and I remember that he went up in his lines on his close-up or something, and I thought, oh my God, I think he probably did it just to make me feel comfortable. And then I think I realized later that he was just drunk.
We've heard that.
Right.
Yeah, no, I think that because he and some of his cronies would go out at lunch, and they had to get their. They had to really get their work done in the morning, because they knew when they came back, they were going to be happy. And they were going to be, and I didn't know any of this at the time. I found all this out later, but, no, he was very supportive of me.
And once again, for our listeners, if you've never seen it, we encourage you to please seek out a copy, because it's really fantastic.
Stanley Donen movie, Stanley Donen.
Yes, yeah.
And it's called Movie, and it's out on DVD or something. I don't think it's Blu-ray yet or anything, but it's just a tongue-in-cheek. My whole career is tongue-in-cheek. My tongue is probably stuck in my cheek, and it will be forever, because I like to send up what people would normally think somebody like me looks like or acts like or am, you know. And so you'll notice a lot of the work I do, or what a lot of the work that's offered me is me, you know, whether it's the Pirates of Penzance, you know, I did the West Coast production of that.
Yeah.
And again, it's sort of, you know, the sort of stuck up
swagger.
Swagger. And, but he's sort of aware of his swagger, you know.
Totally.
It's not like and those are the characters I love to do. I love that sort of twinkle, glint.
Have you ever turned down anything that later on you were like, ah, why did I do that?
I don't turn anything down. I don't. Unless it's just filthy, and even then I'll think twice about doing it. The
right attitude. I like that.
Yeah. No, I don't. You know, if it.
Do you like auditioning? Do you like auditioning?
Yeah. Yeah. I like auditioning. I think all this auditioning at home stuff. is a bit daunting because of all of the equipment that I haven't been able to figure out yet. I like auditioning. Yeah, you know, it gives you a night or two to really think about how you're going to, you know, do a character as opposed to just getting the job and showing up the first day. A lot of the times I wonder why I'm auditioning. I think, I think that they should, when you finally reach my age, there's a handful of us who do television things.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, they should know.
Yes.
What we look like and sound like, because we do so much work, contemporary work, you know, like whether it's a Lifetime movie or a Hallmark movie or an episode of Will and Grace or something. That if they really wanted to see who we were and the fact that we maybe hadn't put on 50 pounds, it's easily gettable. And, sometimes I think the auditioning is a huge waste of time, right now when you're sort of known. I mean, I wouldn't think the body of work is there.
Yeah.
I wouldn't think that Kevin Kline has to audition a lot unless it's something that he feels is a real stretch for him. And, I'm not putting myself in the same category as Kevin Kline, but, you know, we started out together in New York doing similar parts and sort of exchanging. You know, he did the original Robber Bridegroom with the acting company, and then I did the Broadway production. But we have a similar kind of joie de vivre, you know, and I will go the distance if I'm auditioning for something that I'm not normally known for, or not normally they don't see me as that character, you know.
Your performance in The Robber Bridegroom, which is just incredible, just incredible. How did that show come into your orbit, and did you like doing it?
Again, that was one of those shows that it had already been done in the acting company, and they were just wanted to heighten it and bring it to Broadway. So we started it in L.A. I don't remember. I think they just offered me the part. I don't remember. But was that was after Grease, right? Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
It was after Grease.
Yeah.
And Grease gave me an awful lot of legitimacy. And I was getting a lot of things just because they knew me from Grease, and I had been nominated for a Tony for that. And I was just part of that handful of Broadway young leading men, you know. The Robber Bridegroom was, it was an interesting, very interesting show. It was different. It was unusual. That's what I think attracted me to it. The music was just, you know, bluegrass music with four guys on stage. It wasn't a typical Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know, big Oklahoma, but it was something again, tongue in cheek, something that was, just different. And I like Grease was different, that different. A lot of the things I've done have just, I'm attracted to its differences. And
When we come back from the pandemic, would you like to get back on stage again?
No, I don't care to ever be on stage again.
Great. Great.
I love the honesty.
No, I just, I think Arthur Lawrence just blew it for me. You know, I mean, I say that tongue in cheek again, but I really, to me, stage, I mean, I do readings of things.
Sure.
You know, I'll still do stage things, like stage readings. I did a production of Camelot a couple of years ago, raising money for something or whatever.
Sure.
I don't want to learn all those lines, number one.
Yeah, no.
And number two, I don't want to have to remember them all. I can learn them. I'll learn them. I'll do it once, and then I'll get bored by the third time. You know, it's just attention deficit. I think it's like I can focus, but then it's just like, well, why? Why am I spending all this time to, just entertain 300 people who half of them don't want to be there because they were dragged there by their wife? I don't need that ego rush anymore. I don't need to be down in one, singing, I had a dream. Yeah. I'm over that. I like the nuance and the subtlety now of trying to come up with a character with just a, with just a glint in your eye or just a small movement of some kind of a gesture or a coming up with a master gesture for a character or find a prop that is so right for somebody and then using it judiciously.
I love that.
I don't know. I guess I'm not that desperate for attention anymore. I've been married for 26 years and I get a lot of attention at home. I've got two kids in college. And there's another thing. When you have kids in college, you can't work on stage.
Right.
Because you don't make any money. So my kids, would be, hustling food at McDonald's if I did everything just on stage now. So, I mean, that's a very practical, it's also a very practical decision.
Absolutely. You have to keep a roof over your head. You have to keep a roof over your head. And you know yourself well enough to know what you want to spend your time doing. And there's nothing better than that.
Well, there you go. There's the whole interview right there. Thank you.
Thank you. And our last our last question for you, Barry, then we're going to let you go. So now that you've had this amazing decades of experience, let's imagine, coming into New York for the first time when you were
stay out of show business. Come on, listen to me. Come on, become an accountant. Do something that you can actually make a living at. Why do you want to put yourself, and particularly if you're a young woman, oh my God, stay away. Okay, now you want a real answer?
That sounded as real as it could get. What's your real answer?
What's the question again?
It was actually very similar. What would you tell your younger self? Like, what do you know now that you wished you had known then before you started?
My younger self, not other people, but me? No, me. I would say go for 100% because you need the adulation and you're a driven attention whore, and what you need is to continue that way and get to the point where you are satiated in some way, shape, or form, and then you can move on with your life. But right now, go 100% and don't have a drop back position. That's what I always say to people. I say, if you want it, you got to go 100% and don't all of a sudden, get your teaching credentials thinking that you can now go back and teach it at some private school in Pennsylvania. You have to give yourself a certain amount of time, bank some money, and go do it. I don't know how anybody does it these days. Look at all those poor kids who graduated from college and got master's degrees and this and that, showed up in New York in January, and maybe got their first job or didn't even get a job. And now they have had to sit there for a whole year eating up their savings, whatever savings they had. And now they can't even work at a restaurant because the restaurants are closed. So, Jesus, go home.
Yes.
Grow corn. Do something I think that's my advice. Grow corn.
That's the subtitle for this podcast.
Yeah, Grow Corn
with Barry Bostwick. Barry, this has been such a pleasure. I cannot tell you how much we appreciate you taking your time out to talk to us.
Sure.
And thank you so much for also all the wonderful, wonderful things that you've given us on theater and film and television. It's just been an absolute honor getting to speak to you.
Thank you.
Take care, Barry. Take care. Stay safe, stay healthy.
Thank you for listening to today's episode, and a big thanks to the punchy players Jeff Marquis, who is bringing back Lucy, Betty, Judy, and Morda shill for us.
And a big thanks to our sound editor Daniel Schwartzberg and social media manager Bethany Ann Selecki.
And don't forget, we want more folks to hear these incredible stories, and that's where you come in.
In order for people to find out about us, we need lots of ratings on iTunes. So head on over to iTunes, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends, click on our logo, click on ratings and reviews, then write a review and leave us 5 stars and make us feel as special as Eliza Doolittle on Eliza Doolittle Day.
Or you can leave us just 1 star and you can make us feel as bad as Annie did in that really weird production in Boston where Annie dreamt that she was being adopted, but then she ended up back in the orphanage, right? Back where she started. Yeah, true story. Rob saw it.
Yes, and it was Batty. It was bizarre. I was there. I was.
Oh, good.
So head on over to iTunes and make us feel even more special than we already do.
You know what, Patrick Flynn?
What, Beth Amon?
I hate this movie.
Love Actually?
Yes.
Me too.
But I also love it.
Me too.
But I hate it.
You know what we should do?
What?
We should get a bunch of people together, split the movie into its 10 storylines, and then figure out this movie 1 story at a time.
You mean people like Keith Powell and Jill Knox Powell from NBC's Connecting?
Keith, why don't you show us what porn watching faces?
And Washington Post columnist Alexandra Petri?
I don't know. I think every Christmas story is a horror story.
Do you think it would work?
It actually inspired me to plan my funeral.
I dig the brothel angle.
Every time I think about the trailer, I'm like, I was misled.
I love your use of the word shag, by the way.
Play Mix Your Ashes with Glitter.
It's like 8 half screenplays just put in a blender.
I am positive I stayed with my ex an extra 6 months because we saw this in the theater.
It will definitely work.
What is Love Actually? Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download. All episodes out November 27th.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.